Relatively Geeky presents Veterans Day 2017, or Reading War Books with Veterans. Back in 2015, for Veterans Day, I covered on the Quarterbin podcast a 1958 issue of Black Hawk. That issue contained three stories, and I invited three military vets to join, one guest per story. Last year, around October, a listener asked if I would be doing a similar thing for that Veterans Day, as they had really enjoyed the episode from the year before. And the answer was no. I had not planned on doing another Veterans Day episode last year, and I ended up not doing one. But I did decide pretty much right then that I'd do my best to do one this year here in 2017. I did not want to limit myself to the 25-cent books. And again, that Black Hawk book was just so custom-made for that episode, I didn't want to try to just recreate that same thing again. So I decided to make this a Relatively Geeky Presents episode, which just gave me the freedom to cover a wider range of books. But the concept, the big picture, is similar to that Quarterbin podcast from a few years back. And that is reading war comics with military veterans. Now, since I decided to do this up last year, I've been saving my war books. Some of these I did pick up for a quarter, full disclosure. Some were, sit down for this, more expensive than that. And some were sent in by lovely listeners in comic book care packages. So I sent this list of books around to a few of my podcasting colleagues with military service and their pasts. And here we are. Except for one of the guys, he went off book, suggesting a title that I have a ton of, but hadn't really considered for this episode. But as we'll talk about in that segment, that was a pretty big oversight on my part. Now, in addition to the comics I read for this specific episode, I did go ahead and read a handful of other war books, military books that I had on that list, and those I will discuss on the November episode of the Comics Reading Journal, which should come out the first week of December. But right now, we're here to talk war comics with veterans, and we'll start that process right after this. And my first guest for this episode is from White Rocket Entertainment and the Long Box Crusade. It's Jared Albrecht. Welcome to Relatively Geeky, Mr. Yarks. What did you
do? I'm sorry, I got excited.
Well, welcome to Relatively Geeky, Mr. Yard Sale Artist.
Why, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and be part of the program.
Of course, for this segment, we need to refer to you as Captain Jared Albrecht, Communications Officer, United States Air Force, currently in the reserve, is that right?
That's right.
So, how long were you on active duty? And to the extent that you can discuss it, where were you?
I'll never tell. I was, I will tell. I'll immediately flip-flop on that. I was on active duty for 8 years. I commissioned in 1999 via the ROTC program at Auburn University. I served at Pope Air Force Base, North Carolina, Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama, Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, and Camp Victory in Iraq.
The fourth one sounds a little more dangerous.
I like to tell people it was sketchy.
Adventurous? How about adventurous?
It was adventurous. It was an adventurous place. I don't regret doing it, but I wouldn't be excited to do it again. That's how I explain it.
Understood. If memory serves us from hearing you talk on other podcasts, your brother is or was also in the service. And is there other family who served?
There is. My brother was a soldier, as you are correct. And my father was a soldier in Army Aviation. He flew a helicopter. I don't know if it was Hornet or not, but I'll get back to you on that. But yeah, my father was. My Uncle Joe is a Vietnam vet. My grandfather was in the Merchant Marine Corps during World War II. So, yes, it is very much a family tradition that I think is coming to a screeching halt with my son. I have an 11-year-old boy. And I asked him not too long ago, I said, son, do you have any interest in being in the military? And he was like, no. And so I asked him, I was like, well, that's okay, but why not? And he just plain face shoots right back at me. I don't want to get shot. And I was like,
I mean, that's not a crazy answer. Let me just say this. And as a father, I think you may have understood where he was coming from on that one.
Yeah, like I was like, it was weird because when I was 11, that never occurred to me. To me, it was G.I. Joe. The good guys don't get shot. Like, no, my son has actually thought it through much farther than I ever did.
Decision process for you was pretty easy to enter the service generally, and why the Air Force in particular?
It was in my blood. I never considered doing anything else. I knew I wanted to be in the military. And the story of how I selected the Air Force is a bit mundane and mildly humorous at the same time. When you're about a junior in high school, if you're interested in going in the service and becoming an officer, you basically have the choice of going through an ROTC program at a university or going to one of the academies, right? First thing I got back in the mail was an offer from Air Force ROTC that said, we're offering you a full ride 4-year scholarship. And I was very excited. And I showed my dad. My dad was like, heck yeah, take that. And we took it. And I never opened the letters from any of the other places that wrote me. I never even opened them. Because I just like, I've just taken the – so the Air Force won because of their speed of paperwork. That's how they were chosen. A lot of Army in our family. And my father was just like, hey, do the Air Force. They're better than their people. It's a little bit easier of a life. So there was never like a shame. Like, he never made fun of me for being Air Force. And my brother, on the other hand, picks on me for it. So basically, the Air Force won due to speed of paperwork. And let me tell you something. Having served 8 years in the active duty Air Force, we're aces at paperwork, my man.
That's your strength. I imagine that letter was delivered airmail as opposed to the Navy one came on a slow boat. So
he's taking the easy jokes, but they're good. They're good.
I don't even want to know how the Marines would have sent theirs to you. I'm just scared by that.
It's probably scary. Yeah, some guy shows up in your closet. He's like, hey, dude, I'm going to be in the Marine Corps. Oh, good goodness.
You mentioned that you were a G.I. Joe kid.
All the way.
So were there any other, war or war-related, either comics or other things that you read as a kid back in the day?
Not a whole lot. I think it's one of those things that when you're inside a certain bubble, and I'm living my entire life as the son of a soldier, that some things are just like, oh, there's a war comic, but, I'm around this stuff all the time.
Right.
I'm around helicopters and tanks and stuff all the time. So I'm not saying I didn't like it, but
you were hardly ever around people who'd been bitten by radioactive spiders.
Very rarely. Very rarely. As far as the war comics, though, I mean, I liked them, and I'd poke around them a little bit, but I was much more interesting. You should mention that. I was much more of a Spider-Man kid. My brother and I were like Marvel kids for a long time. G.I. Joe came out, obviously Marvel, and the cartoons were coming out, and the action figures. And Jason and I really started with the figures, and then we got into the comics, and I think it was just because a lot of times your war comics, haunted tanks aside, are a little bit more realistic. And I'm a flighty kid, so I want something a little more zippy and pizzazz filled. So G.I. Joe sort of filled that void for me. And because I'm a vat of never ending stories, I was recently at Dragon Con peddling my wares at Dragon Con, and I was very fortunate and very geeked out that really near my table, Larry Hama was like 30 feet away. And I'm like, he's over my right shoulder. So half the con, I'm just looking over my right shoulder like, it's Larry Hama. So I went over and I talked to him a little bit, and he signed some of my G.I. Joe digests because I collect the digests.
All right, great.
And I told him, I said, I just want to let you know that two people have been the greatest influence in my life about joining the military. One was my father and the other was you. And he just kind of chuckled and he goes, that wasn't really my intent. And I went, well, I lived an entire life based off of it. So there you go.
I was trying to sell toys and make a living. Funny thing, next day at the convention, he was 300 feet away from you, not 30.
That's right. Nah, he was great. He was very lighthearted about it. He's a vet himself.
Yeah.
He's a Vietnam vet and a good dude. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was very funny about it. But yeah, so that's my way longer than you wanted history with war comics. vastly G.I. Joe.
Right. You and Pat Sampson from Longbox Crusade, you guys put together a little effort to collect comics for soldiers. And
yes,
within that, on the promo for that, which we have played on the network, you talk about reading comics when you were in the service. So sort of talk about that and sort of plug that effort.
Okay.
Because everyone
yes.
who's listening to this has lots of comics lying around.
I can guarantee you that. That's what we like to hear. The initiative he's talking about is our Comics for Courage initiative. And full credit to Pat Sampson. He came up with the idea after I told him. It's an interesting sort of microcosm of society in that soldiers love comics. Mm-hmm. They just love them. And like you can go back, like if you do a Google image search of soldiers and comics or comics during war, you'll get a bunch of really cool mm-hmm. images of soldiers. Right. Any era, Vietnam, World War II, whatever, kicked back in their bunk or out in the bush, just with comics, and it's never gone away. So when I was in Iraq, the good people from Wizard and Toy Fair magazine, they sent us like 100 pounds of comic books, and there was another box full of food and goodies. Anyway, they're very generous people, and we were like, we're gonna do all these comics, and you know, I did the right thing. As a comic book collector myself, I went through them and took out all the ones I wanted.
And put the rest on eBay. Perfect.
Yeah. And I sold the rest on eBay via Iraq. That's the end of the story. No, I was like, okay, I got the ones that I like and going to want to read. And it was about 20 of those comics. And I actually put them in an envelope, mailed them to myself back home in the States when I got home.
You don't want those falling into enemy hands. And by enemy, I mean, you know, the guys in the bunk next to you.
That's right. That's right.
That's what I mean by enemy.
War gets cagey when it comes to comics, man. We had a give and take library there in the headquarters building where people just dropped off books. You just take whatever you want, drop something off, whatever. It's just so you have some entertainment. And we put the comics down there. We're talking about 100 pounds of comics. It was a lot. And we went back the next day, and they were all gone. True comic collectors would probably scream if they saw, you know, soldiers. We roll them up and stick them in our BDU pocket, you know, the pouch on the side or fold it in half. But they are uniquely portable, you know, as opposed to you're not going to be walking around with a big hardcover book because you can't really carry that. So I told Pat that story, and he got the idea to do Comics for Courage, which is the initiative that we spearhead at Longbox Crusade. And you mentioned people with comics laying around. Well, if you have comics laying around and you kind of want to get rid of them, we just recommend that you put them in a box and send them down to supportourtroops.org. Just put all your comics in a big envelope or a box, the ones you don't want anymore, doubles, whatever, and send them down there. And what the people that support our troops do is they take all the donations they get, and they get tons of stuff day in and day out, food and supplies and comics if you send them. And they just divvy it up into random care packages, and they send them down. Joe Soldier sitting in your unit, and your
mail
unit
call.
All of a sudden all of a sudden you'll get 50 packages that say to any soldier, and they'll just kind of mm-hmm. randomly toss them out. You open it up, and there's, you know, like it's always like Twinkies and maybe a handheld electronic game of poker and a comic book, you know, and you're like, oh, that's great, you know, to take a little time mm-hmm. and have some fun. So that's just encourage supportourtroops.org. You can mail it down there. Like we say on the promo, we know a little bit about comics collectors. If like the idea, but you can't possibly part with any of your comics, we know about these people. Some of us are these people.
Some of us are.
You can donate financially. You can just go put $5-$10 at Support Our Troops, and they'll buy stuff for the troops, and you'd be doing some good. So yeah, that's Comics for
Great
Courage.
Effort. All right. Well, let's get to this comic. You have hinted about it. Today we are talking G.I. Combat 198 featuring the Haunted Tank. This, of course, is from DC Comics, cover dated January 1977. Now, technically speaking, we're only going to look at the first story, the lead story featuring the tank. And this is The Devil Rides a Panzer. Haunted Tank created by, and the story written by Bob Kaniger, with art by Sam Glansman. We start with the Haunted Tank rumbling through avalanche country, careful not to remove the countless tons of snow atop a towering alpine cliff. 2 miles on, our crew finds what's left of Fox Company stranded with a Krautpanzer on their tail 500 yards back. But before they give their brothers a hand, the winter wonderland is shattered by fountains of thunder-red flame. Can you tell this was written in the 70s?
That game was glorious.
And there's another Panzer at 8 o'clock, ready to ambush them. But while the Krauts are still laughing at them, they turn turret and fire at will. The tank's armor-piercing shells slam at the enemy like a blacksmith's hammer. Did I mention this was written in the 70s? They head into a frozen waterfall, luring the second Panzer into their trap. The whooping AP shell turns the Panzer into splintered steel, gushing black smoke. Now our heroes pour it on, but as they approach Saint-Laurent,
they see somewhere in France.
Somewhere in France. Some town name that ends with an X, okay? They see smoke curling up from the city. Being held up to rescue the soldiers and battle the Panzers led them to being late, and the city was destroyed. A man stumbles into the street, claiming that the city was destroyed by a man in an SS colonel's uniform, but his face was made of iron. This man is Colonel von Holzer, who debuted just 4 issues ago, and I guess was pretty popular, because he's back pretty fast. The Steel Superman. They can say that because it's DC. So there's no copyright infringement. Well, he took 3 hostages before leveling the city. And the ghost of Civil War General Jeb Stuart gives us a little backstory. Because I think at this point, Robert Kaniger realized, oh, that's right, this is a weird war story. Not just a war story. Because up to this point, it's been very straight.
Yeah, it's a straight shot until you get to the robotic metal colonel.
We need that and the ghost of Jeb Stuart. Okay, boom. Right. Now we're back. The tank comes upon one of the hostages dead. A note tells them to halt their pursuit, or a hostage will die every mile. But they come across another dead hostage, and it's been less than a mile because von Holzer is a murderous liar.
You can't trust a robot metal Nazi man.
Then,
I mean, who can you trust?
Then who can you trust? They see his Tiger tank in the distance, and Slim and Rick set out on a recon mission. But von Holzer finds them, leaves them for dead. But as the Honda tank rolls up, they find and rescue their men, who are only mostly dead. When they find the last of the hostages actually dead, the actual soldier, Jib, not the ghost, stands in the middle of the snow-swept valley, one man with a gun, staring down a steel soldier in a tank. And our man fires his weapon, but not at the tank or the enemy. Because remember, this is avalanche country. The overhead of mountainous snow momentarily shudders, then boils down in a white torrent, smothering everything in its path in a pale shroud. The team digs frantically to find Jeb, who held his gun up high as the snow fell. They find him and dig him out. They're alive to fight another day. But that devil is back in hell. Except that in the final panel, with gears grinding and metal clanking, we see the steel Nazi pull him out of the snow. The end. But we know it's only the end for now.
Well done.
Now, Jared, you picked this issue off a list that had about a dozen possibilities. And I expect you did so because this was just so reminiscent of your time in the desert?
That's right. This is exactly the way it was in Iraq. The only thing we didn't have was snow and avalanches. We didn't have the ghosts of Civil War generals. We had no Nazis, metal or otherwise. But aside from that,
it's pretty much the same.
It's spot on.
You
except
wish...
I spent no time in a tank at all.
What, the Air Force doesn't have a lot of those?
No, we're not heavy on the tanks, man. Although I will say this, when I deployed to Iraq, I deployed with an army unit. I was one of two Air Force people in an army unit, so I was like a liaison type officer. So I did spend a lot of time with the army guys, but I never rolled in a tank.
But there were plenty of days in the desert you wish you'd been in these snow-swept alpine mountains, perhaps?
You know, a lot of people, you know, you hear Baghdad in Iraq, you think, oh, it's hot and it's terrible. But pretty much between October and February, it gets pretty chilly and it rains all the time. Like, people think desert, so it doesn't rain, but, like, it rains a lot. And the sand over there is very, 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 very fine. Mm-hmm. And once it mixes with water, it almost becomes like cement. And it just cakes up on your boots until it's so heavy to walk, and it's icky, as we say in the Air Force.
That's the technical term.
It's icky.
That's pretty harsh language. You might want to dial that back a little. I'll let you say icky just once or twice more. We're gonna have to censor this. This is gonna have to be explicit if you keep using that kind of language.
Yeah, I'm sure the soldiers and the Marines have a better word for it, but I'm going with icky. But yeah, no, this doesn't have a lot of similarities between here and there.
But I gotta say, it was a pretty fun story.
Yeah, oh, gosh,
I mean, the first half of it is basically, could have been a G.I. Joe story. You know, it's a straight kind of strategic war story.
It is. It really is. And there are some parts of it that actually do ring very true, like the camaraderie of the guys in the tank.
Sure.
You know, their willingness to, immediately, no hesitation. They know they need to get to St. whatever the name of the city was. But they saw, you know, fellow soldiers in trouble, and, you know, that precedence over everything.
Absolutely.
You know, they got to take care of their buddies. And that part is true. I mean, the camaraderie of that, and I like, you know, not to get crazy, like, political on your podcast or anything, but I like how we've got a 70s war comic with a diverse crew.
It's true.
Because that's how soldiers are. I mean, the military has been a very diverse organization for a very long time. So I thought that was neat. And they're a well-oiled machine, literally and figuratively, I suppose. But yeah, those parts do ring true.
Yeah. One of the things I liked in this early section, the first, you know, third or first half, something, I mean, I'm sure tanks can get up to a decent clip in terms of, you know, how fast they go, but I would think a tank in the snow is not moving all that fast, and there's something sort of dramatic, at least in my imagination, of the slow speed chase. You know, there's something, you know, because these tanks, I mean, these are relentless machines. They might not be coming fast, but they are coming. Something kind of tense about that sort of extended time of this chase. And I think that's kind of dramatic.
It is, and they do a lot of that. And I know I'm going kind of beyond this issue. I'm kind of a recent fan of Haunts and Tank stuff, like within the last few months. Recent. a tip of the cap to my friend Kirk Spencer, who's the biggest war comics nut I know. He bought some art from me. I'm putting the word "bought" in air quotes, because when we got together to bring the deal down, he's like, "Well, I can pay you cash, or
I can pay."
And then like pulls back the curtain. He's got all these comics. He goes, "These are my doubles and triples," and we're talking like 10, 12 long boxes. And I started looking through them, and I said, "You know what? I'm going to give this Haunted Tank thing a try because I like the wacky and weird, like a super realistic war comic still won't appeal to me that much. I mean, I'll respect it for what it is, and I like it. But like when you add haunted tanks or like soldiers versus dinosaurs or robotic Nazi colonels, you're up my alley at this point. So, yeah, so I got kind of hooked on it from Kirk. I've read a couple other haunted tanks, and they do a good job of using that theme of the slow moving, almost unstoppable tank, though. And I think don't quote me on this because I'm not the world's biggest expert, but I want to say the top speed of these tanks we're talking World War II is in the 20s.
Right.
Like 22, 25 miles per hour.
Right. But whatever that number is, your planes can go faster.
In terms of speed, I mean, we're winning that one.
Let's not get carried away.
But like you said, the tanks back then, like I said, I think they're around 20, 25 miles an hour. So, yeah, it is not a high-speed adventure chase. It's a game of cat and mouse, and it's really a game of angles and whose crew is faster at loading that next round. And so there's a lot of cool tension, like you were saying, to be found in something like that.
This area where they are, this valley, you know, underneath this snow-peaked mountain, does not, it's not identified here, but I'm pretty sure that is the Valley of Foreshadowing. I think is what that's called.
The Valley of Foreshadowing.
But that's actually a good technique. Is there on about the second page, they say, you know, we're driving by here. Got to be careful. We're an avalanche country. We're not just going to fire the weapon willy nilly, because you never know what's going to happen. And then, you know, 12 pages later, that's the resolution to the story. So,
yeah, they're.
I mean, they laid the groundwork. They did. There's nothing wrong with that.
They show the cards a little early. Like, okay, we're an avalanche country. But to be honest with you, as a first-time reader, I mean, obviously when they go into that, give a whole panel to it, you know it's going to come into play. Right. But I was still interested in seeing how, you know. Mm-hmm. So when I got to the moment, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, how Jeb went and stood the enemy tank down, man to tank. He's just one man standing out there. And you're like, oh, man, what's he going to do? And then he uses the avalanche to his benefit.
Right.
Creates a poignant moment, even though it was the last hostage dead. I'm not sure why he didn't just go tank to tank on that, why he risked going out by himself.
And look, I don't want to give the robotic Nazi any ideas, any suggestions, but if you have hostages, their value is them being alive.
Yeah,
is the value. So I mean, again, I'm not here to judge the evil super Nazi, but just not that bright.
No, it's not. You're right. His tactics were a little off on that. You might think that evil super robotic Nazi is the most fantastic part of the story, or maybe even a tank that's haunted by the ghost of Civil War General Jeb Stuart. But I got to tell you, what really took me away, like, oh my God, this is like, how the heck does this happen? Was how the heck do you get a frozen waterfall? Like, how cold does it have to be?
And how quick does it have to?
And yes, apparently it dropped to -40 degrees in 8 minutes out here in the Valley of Foreshadowing.
But let's be honest, pretty cool visual. Great concept. It is a good
great
visual.
Concept, cool visual, but I'm like, how does that work? Like, moving water is really hard to freeze. So anyway, but that is the only, like, it's funny, I was about to say, that's the only silliness of the comic. We'll overlook the, you know, metallic Nazi colonel and the haunted tank. But like I said, I like zaniness in the war story, because I think if it's too real, it just, frankly, it's depressing to me a little bit if the war story is too real.
And that's why God made G.I. Joe.
Exactly.
For those stories.
And this falls more in that line of a little dash of realism and a little dash of fantastical and... It's a lot of fun. I've discovered I really like these haunted tank stories. I probably read about 5 or 6 other ones.
Right. Great.
In addition to this. Now, Kirk, I'm going to get this one from Kirk. That's right. I ordered this one off of eBay. When you gave me the list of ones to choose from, I was like, well, I'm really enjoying the haunted tank thing.
That's great.
I said, I'll just go ahead and order it. So, yeah, I bought this off eBay. I think it cost me like $6. That's worth it. I mean, it's no quarter bin. I hope I didn't insult the whole show.
No, it's okay.
It's not very yard sale artist either. You know, I kind of stepped out, but we're not talking about the backstory though, huh? I like the backstory too. We'll leave that a mystery for the listeners.
OSS, the ship that wouldn't die.
As I recently learned, because I didn't read a lot of war comics, but now I've been reading them. The backstory is usually a more educational story,
right?
As what I've learned, you know. Mm-hmm. And I learned about what they call, well, I don't want to ruin it for you, but something to do with Q-ships. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Spoilers.
And actually, as a guy who knows a fair amount about military history and stuff, I didn't know about Q-ships, so that was fun for me. Mm-hmm. I have just two things that I wanted to point out just to try to add a little something to the show. Not that it needs anything. Don't take offense. near the back, outside of the haunted tank, back in the Q-ship story, there was an ad that really caught my eye. I know you don't do a lot of ads on the show, but there's an ad for Christmas ideas from Super Friends. It's very near the back. It's the last ad before the letters page. Super Baby Ragdolls, which creep. Sorry, creep the crap out of me. Sorry about that, military guy. Editing time. But yeah, those creeped me out. But the talking bat clock on that ad.
Oh, nice, right?
I own that, and I got it like 2, 3, maybe 4 years ago for my birthday from my sister.
The dynamic duo personally wake you up every morning.
Yes, and they do talk, and it's like it's about as cool as it looks in the ad. Most of these things are lamer when you get them in real life, but it's pretty cool. My sister got it for me, found it in a junk shop a few years ago and got it for me for my birthday, and it's a really, really neat little piece. So that I was like, oh, wow, I own that clock. So that's just my stupid personal aside. But what I thought I would tell you to add educational value to the show.
Yes.
You take a look at the cover, and you see who drew the cover, right?
The great Joe Kubert.
Classic Joe Kubert. King of the War comics. Joe Kubert actually did a lot, and I mean a lot.
Oh, yes.
Of comic Preventative Maintenance Monthly magazine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is a magazine in the military that soldiers get to learn how to, you know, it's a different item in every issue. It's the M16 or the M60 or a different kind of rifle or a different tank or a piece of equipment or anything between here and there. And it teaches them how to perform preventative maintenance on that, you know, to make the items last longer and how to take care of the equipment and stuff like that. And they're all drawn by Joe Kubert. And he drew for the Army for, gosh, decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling some folks about that, because there's some folks out there that really love Joe Kubert and they love his military stuff. And so if you're the kind of collector that loves Joe Kubert, it's a very affordable thing too to start tracking down old Preventative Maintenance Monthlies. If you want more Joe Kubert art in your mm-hmm. life, you can seek those out, and they're pretty interesting. Although I was looking on eBay, I think more and more people are figuring that out.
Yeah.
The okay. prices are going up. And it was funny because in my day job, I'm a contractor that I work for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And we do maintenance on helicopters. So Preventive Maintenance Monthly does come in. And to this day, they still use some Joe Kubert art. And I asked just a couple weeks ago, I asked my office mate, I said, hey, when you're over there with talking to the maintenance guys, see if you can snag me the latest Preventive Maintenance Monthly. And she was like, fine, I'll do that. And she came back, she gave it to me. And it says on the cover, this is going to be the last ever issue of Preventive Maintenance Monthly. They're going to do it electronically, so you can look at it on like tablets and stuff, but this is the last printed issue, and I was like, whoa,
okay,
end of an era.
I'm keeping this one.
That's right. It didn't have any Kubert art in it. It had the new person who took over, who's actually pretty good too.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw the Joe Kubert, and I thought, you know, for the fans out there listening that might enjoy this kind of stuff, that's a neat little niche you can go out if you want to start collecting more stuff, because we all know that we're all collectors, and
yes,
we like to collect collections. You know, that's why
right,
I collect
right.
collections. But yeah, there's an interesting little pocket of Joe Kubert art out there that you may not know about that you can look into. So Preventive right. Maintenance Monthly.
There you go. And that is your collector's tip of the day.
Happy to be of service. No pun intended.
Jared. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for joining me on this episode.
Oh, it was an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Captain Albrick, thank you for your service.
It was an honor to serve. It's been a long time since somebody called Captain Albrick a kick out of it, but I do appreciate it. Again, it was truly an honor to serve this country.
And next up, it's another Air Force dude, Co Honcho at the Two True Freaks Podcast Network. It's Senior Airman Scott Gardner.
Welcome. Hey, how's it going? I haven't gone by that title in a very long time, but
well, welcome to the Veterans Day special.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I appreciate you asking me. I was honored to be asked.
Well, I know you have a particular pet peeve that comes up twice a year. Well,
oh yes,
listeners
yes.
know you have many pet peeves, but you've one that comes up twice a year. So just so all our listeners know, for 100% certainty, can you explain the difference between Veterans Day and Memorial Day?
Yes, I see this all the time, that the two are greatly confused by the average American. And it started out as kind of a joke kind of thing, like, you know, hey, you know, there is a difference here. But over time, it has grown from a molehill to a mountain that really just, it drives me nuts because people seem to want, you know, Americans seem to want to use them interchangeably, and they are not interchangeable. They are very distinct holidays. So Memorial Day is the day when we remember and memorialize the sacrifice of our military men and women who gave all, you know, who lost their lives in the defense of our country and our freedoms. That's Memorial Day in a nutshell. Veterans Day is not Memorial Day. Veterans Day is the day that we honor our folks that have served in uniform, whether it be the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, at some point in their lives. So they have a veteran status, whether active, non-active, retired, whatever. It is not meant to memorialize veterans that died in the line of duty. That's Memorial Day. So that's the distinction there. And why this causes such great confusion, I couldn't tell you. But every year I see it. And, you know, as you and I were talking and kind of laughing about before we got recording, I'm pretty much like clockwork. Every Memorial Day and every Veterans Day, I have a favorite meme that I post that basically says, yeah, if we could, you know, it's the famous Office Space one, you know, that says, yeah, you know, if you could stop confusing Memorial Day and Veterans Day, that would be great.
Obviously, they both have a sense of seriousness to them, but Memorial Day really is a more solemn day.
Yes.
And to me, Veterans Day is a more grateful, thankful.
Yes.
Maybe not joyous, but closer to it.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, a more positive.
I look at it as Veterans Day is a celebration. You know, it's meant to be a party, a thank you party of sorts. You know, thank you for your service. We appreciate it type of thing. Whereas Memorial Day is also, I think it should be, not completely somber, but, you know, also a thank you of sorts. But it is, you know, ultimately it is a remembrance. It's almost like a national wake, you know what I mean, for okay, those right. that gave their lives. That's kind of the way I look at that.
Tell us about your time in the service. When did you enlist? How old were you? How long were you in?
Oh, wow.
What to do? Can you remember any of those details at this point?
Yeah, that's the thing. We're going way back. Set the way back machine. I was pretty much fresh out of high school. I enlisted in late 1986. So I had graduated in June of 1986. I don't remember the exact enlistment date, although I know that my service date began in November. Now, here's the funny thing is that I have trouble remembering the exact date only because with my current career, I work for the Walt Disney Corporation, and my date with them is either the 9th or the 19th of November. I believe it's the 9th. My military one was either the 9th or the 19th of November. So I have trouble remembering which is
the
which.
Other one.
I think if I remember right, my current one is the 9th and the military one was the 19th. I think that's right. But anyway, went in November, enlisted in the Air Force. And it's funny because it was not planned far out in advance or anything. It was, I don't want to say it was out of desperation, but it was out of a sense of yearning I'd had for a long time to, as soon as I graduated, get the heck out of the little town that I grew up in. I grew up in a little town in upstate New York called Carthage, which if you've never heard of it, yeah, well, there's a reason for that. It's about the size of a head of a pin. And what's funny now, you know, looking back at it, my the co-creator of Tutor Freaks, Chris Honeywell, you know, he's my best friend. We basically grew up together in Carthage. We both have adopted a semi-nostalgic view looking back at it now, where it seems right. like it was a very, I was going to say Orwellian, that's not right, a very Rockwellian, that's very, very different there, Rockwellian and Orwellian. Very Rockwellian vision of what it was like. It wasn't like that, but it was, you know, compared to what towns are like today, it was kind of like that. You know, there wasn't a lot going on there. And what I feared was my future might be was what I saw happening to so many of my friends and, you know, their older brothers and uncles and dads and grandfathers was being kind of stuck in this small town where, you know, it was just boring and your life was kind of, you know, you could see where it was going to go because of you know, the available work and that sort of thing. So I desperately wanted out of it.
This was either a chance to get out, mm-hmm. or at least to see the world before coming back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I joined to see the world, and after doing two stints at Lackland Air Force Base, because the first stint was, of course, basic training at Lackland, and then the second stint was for the Security Police Academy, because that's what I had gone in for, was for police work, with an eye at the time towards possibly being a New York State trooper when I got out. That was kind of the half-form plan. I'd never gone in with the intention of you know, being a lifer or anything. It was really I was going to do 4, maybe possibly 8, and then get out. And then when I got my assignment, now all of my buddies, my flight mates that I went through basic and Security Police Academy with, they're all getting these assignments. You know, they were going to, you know, to England or, you know, all these different places. And I finally got my assignment and I was so excited. And it was for Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York, which was less than an hour from where I grew up. So, you know, it was.
You really got out of seeing the world.
Yeah. You know, it was one of those things where, well, I'm seeing a different area of New York I've never seen before, but other than that, you know, it was not exactly seeing the world. So I did my time there, and this, you know, by the time 1990 rolled around, Bush Senior was the president. They were downsizing. You know, we'd had a pretty sustained period of peace at that point and everything, and they were looking to just kind of downsize the military and everything. And there was a completely elective program that they rolled out called the Early Out Program, which was essentially intended for if you knew you were not going to reenlist and basically if you were just ready to go right now, you could go ahead and you could sign up for that. And if you were eligible for it, they would go ahead and release you pretty much right then and there. At the time, I was engaged to be married and had things I thought lined up pretty well, you know, in the civilian sector and everything. Had no intentions of re-upping or anything. So I went ahead and I took that. And that was in March, I believe, of 90. So got out about, what is that, about 9 months early. So altogether served about 3 years and about a third of a year, something like that.
Why the Air Force in particular?
A lot of it was because I had grown up with...
Because you knew Bill Robinson was in the Navy? Was that pretty much... That was,
yeah, I
crossed
I didn't
that
know
off.
Bill back then. I didn't know Bill back then. I wish I had. A lot of it was because I grew up with an Air Force... not Air Force, an Army base in my backyard, literally in my backyard.
Right.
I grew up with Fort Drum Army base. I mean, it literally was in my backyard. And my uncle ran a little hot dog stand. It eventually became, for a time, a small chain of restaurants and serviced the army men that were at the base as restaurants. So I knew a lot about kind of the culture of the base and everything and kind of the army culture and everything. And one of the things I gleaned from those guys was that if I ever wanted to go into the service, the Army was definitely not the one that I wanted to go into. And that
you
was
knew it too
that
well.
Wasn't like my yeah, you know, that wasn't my so much my opinion. It was like listening to the other guys, you know, and a lot of them had said things like, you know, Jesus, if I had to do this all over again, you know, I'd go to one of the other branches and everything. And I remember the Air Force and both the Air Force and the Navy being mentioned quite often and everything. And just, you know, from my own research and things I knew and everything, it always seemed to me like the Army, the Air Force, rather, just had a certain prestige above and beyond the other armed services. I don't know why that is. And I didn't know until later the kind of stigma that the Air Force has as kind of being the light one, you know, the easy duty one and all of that. I disagree with that. I kind of chafe against that perception, you know, being an Air Force veteran. But at the same rate, I can kind of see in certain aspects where they may get that reputation. We definitely were not the Marines, you know, but at the same rate, you know, I've often heard it said that, you know, the Air Force boot camp is, you know, like a country club and all these, you know, the little jabs that the other services take at us. It was not that. I remember, boot camp, and especially the Security Police Academy, being, you know, it was pretty intense, especially for me, who was, you know, had grown up a comic book nerd and was not terribly athletic. You know, it definitely put some meat on the bone, you know, some muscle on the bone. So
how did your service in the military affect your comic book reading? I mean, this is prime late teens, early 20s, prime geek years.
You know, I would say that the best way that it benefited me was the fact that I think, honestly, at least for the period of comics that I've been interested in, I honestly think that that period from about maybe like 1982 to sometime in the mid 90s, I think is about the best period that comics ever had. Mm-hmm. I honestly do. Now, maybe that's just because the era I grew up in, right, you know, in the era I was most invested in comics, but I really think it was. And that, especially that period between about, say, 1985 and 1988, 89, you know, I grew up a DC boy. And I think that's the single period where DC was firing on all cylinders. Everything they were putting out was fantastic, from Superman to Batman to the revamped Wonder Woman, The Flash, Green Lantern was doing interesting things, the Justice League. I mean, there were so many great things coming out from just DC alone. And that's not even counting the Marvel stuff, which at that time I kind of dabbled in, but I was never at that time terribly faithful to any particular Marvel property. I kind of dropped in and dropped out, you know, with fads and things like that. But DC was just, man, were they firing on all cylinders. And it was just a great time to be alive. And if I hadn't had a steady gig like the Air Force, that not only were they paying me, but they were providing me, you know, a bed and a roof over my head and clothes on my back and the food that I mean, all of that stuff was essentially paid for. I mean, I was a single airman living in the barracks, you know, so I had tons of disposable income, exactly, right at the right time when tons of comics were coming out that I wanted to buy. You know, if I had been working at, you know, Taco Bell, I would never have been able to afford all this stuff.
With an apartment and a car payment.
Yeah. So I would have missed so much of the prime time of comics in my life if it hadn't been for that stretch that I did in the Air Force, where I essentially had, you know, nothing but money to blow. I pretty much had the freedom that I could buy pretty much whatever I wanted to comic book wise. And at that time, I can remember dropping, you know, you have to remember this was at a time when comics were what, like 75 cents, something like that. Man. And I was spending a couple $100 a week on comics.
Man, oh man.
And buying, you know, I remember buying like 3 and 4 copies of Amazing Spider-Man 300 when it was on the stands. And, you know, just basically that was also the, at least to my mind, that was kind of the height of the, well, I was going to say it was the height of the speculator boom. It was kind of the height of the beginning of the speculator boom, if you know what I mean. And so people were doing that. You know, they were buying 2 and 3 copies of the latest McFarlane book or whatever. And I was right a part of that as well. And, you know, I mean, just what an exciting time to be a comics enthusiast. And it was fantastic. So it really facilitated my enjoyment of comics, but also it really facilitated my starting to amass a collection at that point.
Yes.
Plus, you know, with the disposable income like that, not only was I had the freedom to buy pretty much anything that was coming out at the stands, that's when I got hooked on buying collections. I don't think that this is so much a thing anymore, but back then I was a newspaper hound as far as like going through the classified ads and these different things and finding listings for garage sales and yard sales and things like that. And going, right, and I would haunt all of the local like Salvation Army and Goodwill stores. And back during those days, it just seemed like it was a hell of a lot easier to find comic books. I mean, comics were pretty much everywhere at that time. And one of my favorite things to do was to find that mom that was cleaning out because her kids had gone off to school or whatever, and buy that collection for $50 of, you know, little Johnny's, you know, old comic books. I mean, I got some real gems doing that. But also, again, that was the beginning of starting to really amass a collection to a point where the show I'm most currently active in is Back to the Bins with Paul Spataro and Dr. Bill Robinson. And, you know, it's a show all focused on back issues. And I've often said on that show, I don't remember where I got this. It was just through the process of osmosis. And what I mean is that process of buying huge collections. And then you forget, you know, you forget exactly where you got a particular issue because you bought, you know, some massive collection that had hundreds, maybe thousands of issues in it.
And you may very well have bought that comic more than once as part of a couple of different collections.
Yeah, that has definitely happened to me. But it started to teach me the basic economics of how to do it, which was, you know, buy a massive collection, pull out the stuff you really want, and then try to turn the other stuff around to at least get back what you paid for the initial collection, maybe turn a profit. Sometimes that would happen, sometimes it wouldn't, but I was always happy to at least get back what I put into it, which almost always happened. So essentially you're getting free comics. And I love that. And it quickly took me from having, you know, a few hundred comics when I was living with mom and dad to, you know, thousands of comics. So,
Well, the book you picked for this episode is Captain America, Theater of War, Ghosts of My Country. It's Marvel Comics, of course, December 2009. That's pretty modern for you, I'm just going to say.
Oh, yeah. if memory serves, I think I became aware of this. We had done a Captain America miniseries on Back to the Bins, and it was Paul and Bill and I and a friend of ours, Michael Bailey. And I think I learned about these Theater of War issues through Michael Bailey, if I'm not mistaken. And it's weird because they're kind of sort of a miniseries, but they're all released in like a one shot under the banner of Theater of War.
Right.
So they're all by different writer creators and everything. And they're a real mishmash. Some of them are really good. Some of them are not so good, but this one really struck a chord with me.
Yeah. There was a series of seven, I think seven or eight.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And I think maybe three of them were written by Paul Jenkins, including this one. Before we go into the details of this one, but where does Cap rank for you? You said you're not really a Marvel guy.
I wasn't growing
up. Where does
Cap
fit into your reading and collecting?
It's funny because now when I was teaching at Disney in my current job, one of the things we'd always do in the beginning of classes just as kind of an icebreaker was we would ask for favorites, you know, to get the class talking, you know, like what's your favorite Disney movie or what's your favorite Disney theme park attraction, that sort of thing. And sometimes we would do what's your favorite Disney character. And more often than not, when I was asked what's my favorite Disney character, I would usually say Captain America. He's a recent acquisition from Disney, but I think he kind of embodies those Disney characteristics, if you know what I mean, especially, you know, Walt himself. So I look at Cap very much that way. I have since become much more a Marvel boy than a DC boy just through recent developments with DC. They kind of lost me, unfortunately. I really love Marvel and I really love the characters. But if there's one I latch onto more than any other, it's definitely Cap. I like everything he represents, everything he stands for. He's very Superman-like in that aspect of he's just, you know, a good guy trying to do the right thing. But I also like that he represents the country in the best way, more or less apolitically, which is a really tough gig to pull off. You know what I mean? It's tough to appeal to everybody on all sides equally and be looked at as a figure that's I'm blanking on the word I want to use, but, you know, just inspiring and you know, that you would aspire to be and still remain more or less apolitical. That's tough. And Cap more or less manages to pull that off. More often than not pulls that off. And I think that's pretty neat.
Well, that's really what this issue does. It takes that idea of Cap as the spirit of America.
Right.
And really runs with it, embodying it, sort of the spirit of Captain America. I mean, we basically have an overview of American military history here. We go from Independence Day to Francis Scott Key, pinning the Star Spangled Banner, World War II, Vietnam, 9/11. We've got the spirit of America, or the spirit of Captain America, always being with us. And said no one embodies that better than Steve Rogers does. And he appears in a sort of a ghostly form at the end of each of these little vignettes that make up the book. I think it's a very cool, beautiful little comic story.
I think of the ones under this banner, this is the one that I felt was the most poignant. And it's interesting because no particular sequence in this, and as you say, it goes from Independence Hall to the Revolutionary War to the Civil War and just basically any conflict America had been in. The World Wars and all these different conflicts. None of these are particularly long. I'd be surprised if there's any one of these sequences that's more than 5 pages. Yet it gives you just enough to get invested in whatever the sequence or whatever the characters are in that particular sequence and tie it all together with the spirit of America, with Captain America. And that's what an amazing, what an amazing magic trick. The one I was really struck by was the one that's in the Ardennes in 1945 with the, see if I can tell what rank, I guess he's a captain. Basically, he's dying and he knows it. And he's writing a love letter to his family. And the last panel we see is where he is then passed. And it says, I see a ghost of my country. And it's Cap looking very sad, very looking very morose, like reaching out to this dead soldier. And it's what a beautiful sequence, hauntingly beautiful.
It's a slightly oversized book. It's about 36 pages maybe of content. But there's 7 or 8 vignettes in here. So it is 3, 4, 5 pages each, but yet you do get not just sort of the historical overview. You do zoom in on a couple of characters in each case.
Did you have really a favorite sequence in this? Because I know I definitely did.
I was raised in Maryland, so the Fort McHenry, the Francis Scott Key part. The Baltimore Harbor, that just always worked for me. I mean, we're a young country.
Yep.
Really just finding our footing, really, in a new, in a changed world. And I thought that one was pretty intense.
That is my favorite as well.
We fought the revolution, and then this is really the first, in essence, defense of that.
Right. Yeah, I love that sequence. The art is beautiful.
And it's just beautiful. It's a windswept, rainy day on the boat. I mean, it's does all of that really well, too.
It really captures, the feel of what you can imagine it must have been like in real life. Right. And I like that. It's not some storybook, watered-down version.
Right.
It's very intense. These guys are under fire, and they're in the middle of a battle, which I can remember learning about this story as a child in grade school and not really having that picture painted for me. It was almost like Francis Scott Key was like some impartial observer of the battle. But no, here he's a participant. He's in danger of losing his life while he watches the
bombs,
the rockets, red flare. Exactly. Yeah. And that's pretty intense. I really like that sequence.
There's a scene towards the very end, sort of almost in the summing up page, where we've got an astronaut on the moon.
Yes.
And reflected in his visor, we see the American flag, and of course, Cap is there holding it up. And I know you're a fan of the space program as well, so
yeah.
I thought of you on that one.
Yeah, that's a great one. It's very much a take on the famous Aldrin picture where Armstrong's reflected in his visor, but instead in this one, it's Cap reflected. That's pretty cool. I like that. That is very cool.
Yeah, the Civil War one is just really sad.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, that's a low point for American history, but Cap is there as well. So it's got that, for good and ill. Aspect to it. Obviously, the 9/11,
that
sequence towards the end is obviously pretty intense as well.
That one's just shocking when you turn the page and get to that one, because the one prior to it, which I think is Vietnam, That one ends on a very brutal note, and then you turn the page, and suddenly it's the 9/11 one, and just the stark black and white that you're using in that really is effective. It's a punch in the gut. Yeah, I thought this was a phenomenal read. It's
great.
It's
choice.
Interesting because
great
it's
choice, Scott.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Beautiful comic story. Great choice. Thanks for bringing this one.
Absolutely.
Scott, thanks for joining me on this one. And Senior Airman Gardner, thank you for your service.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Bringing this episode in for a smooth landing, we're talking to the breakout star from Quarterbin 100. You remember him, my buddy, Terry Colucci.
Hey, Professor Allen, glad to be here. Glad you're having me back.
Yeah, you passed the audition.
Apparently, I didn't do too poorly.
Or should we say Captain Colucci, Ohio Air National Guard. How about that?
That is correct. Actually, it's for weekend this weekend, so I'll be putting the uniform on.
Perfect. So how long were you? Just tell us just a little bit about your career, where you were stationed, that sort of thing.
I actually joined the Air Force in September of 2001. You may remember an incident happened around that. I had been talking to a recruiter the month previous to that. And I was kind of on fence, and then 9/11, and I was like, okay, I pretty much got to do it now.
Yep.
I had been in grad school. I'd gotten my teaching license, and I didn't get picked up by any schools. So I thought, well, you know, they only hire once a year. So I said, well, what am I going to do until the next school year starts?
You got some time to kill.
Fine. You know, I got 12 months I need to occupy myself with. I had a really good friend who was in the Marine Reserves. He's like, hey, come join the Marines. I said, no, maybe I could do the Army National Guard. So I open up the phone book, and don't you know, here comes before Army in the phone book. And I said, what the heck is this? Sign me up, you know. So I went in, talked to them, and then 9/11. So by the end of the month, I had sworn in, and I enlisted into the Ohio Air National Guard. And the interesting thing about the Guard in this era is it really is I wouldn't even call it a sister service. I mean, it's a fully active component of the service. So our deployment rates are the same as active duty. We work side by side interchangeably with active duty. And it's much different than it has been in years past. I mean, ever since 9/11, things have just... The operation tempo has been much, much higher. So, you know, when you ask about have I done active duty service, I haven't been a member of the active duty Air Force per se, but I've deployed several times for several months on end and, you know, worked side by side with active duty personnel, same living conditions.
I mentioned earlier in the episode that I did a similar Veterans Day podcast a couple of years ago, and you were one of the folks who was on the list. Unfortunately, you were spending some quality time, as we would say in DC Comics, in Umek, or Karak at the time, and it made it a little tricky to have you on the show a couple of years ago.
I was in Karak. actually, that particular... I might have actually been in Bialya at that point. They have rebounced a little bit on that tour. So actually, for my career, I've had the opportunity to do a couple different things. I spent 11 years enlisted as an aircraft maintainer. And I got to tell you, for a non-technical guy, that was a really great career choice for me. You know, my bachelor's degree was in pure math, not even applied math. It's, you know, theoretical math. And then my master's degree was in education. I mean, it's about as hands-off as you can get, which is funny because in my family, I was the handy guy.
I hear those degrees and I think airplane maintenance.
Yeah. So they sent me off to school for 6 months, teach me how to fix airplanes. And I tell you what, it gave me just an incredible amount of confidence.
Sure.
Yeah. Just to take things apart, troubleshoot things, and, you know, really just kind of, you know, have the self-confidence to figure some stuff out. So I did that for 11 years, worked at KC-135. It's a aerial refueler. It's basically a 707. And it can hold about 200,000 pounds of fuel. And it is a what we call a force multiplier that we're able to, well, for example, like an F-16. You know, we've got a couple of those on the coast. We'll say it's, say you've got an F-16 in D.C. You want to send it over to Europe. Well, their fuel tanks aren't big enough to get them all the way over there. So we would send, you know, a refueling aircraft, and it'll meet them up halfway, and they can regas in midair and then continue on. And, you know, it really does enable us to get our forces in position much, much more quickly than if we didn't have that capability. So,
am I right in remembering that you have family who served in the military? You lived in England for a while. Was that related to your father's?
Yes. He was actually a civilian contractor.
Okay. Gotcha.
Not too different from what I'm doing now. He was the Air Force librarian, the base librarian.
Oh, nice.
He had the opportunity to stay in England. We went there when I was 6 years old. That's actually where I got most of my comics from for a long time, was at the local, the on-base bookstore, the Stars and Stripes bookstore. And they got, I think, I want to say about a dozen comic books. A dozen different titles, you know, but it was only the big name. You had Superman, sure. You had Batman. I don't even think you got Wonder Woman. I don't think we got Flash. Definitely didn't get Green Lantern because I really wanted that one and I could never get it. I was always so hungry for crossovers. Like, oh, I want to.
That's right.
And then the Marvel books, they got X-Men, they got Spider-Man, Captain America, Iron Man.
So I would hope they got Captain America.
And the Avengers. They definitely got the Avengers. But, I mean, Marvel, aside from the X books, most of the Marvel stuff just, it really wasn't super popular. It didn't have the brand recognition of Superman, Batman. So, but I would go there, you know, monthly, get my comic books. The store owner knew me. And there was, after I got old enough, I was able to go into one of the local towns, and I would buy them from a British store. They actually had
nice
British comic book stores.
Right.
And in fact, if memory serves, you made it to one of my old favorite places in the heart of London,
Forbidden Planet. Yes.
Yeah.
The classic store.
Bastion of pop culture. I remember there being a life-size Predator model there that was just terrifying. Good time. Good time.
Well, for this, the book you picked was an issue of Warlord, and that's a series that I love, but when I was thinking about a war comic, this was not really on my mind. You know, I think of it as a fantasy, a sword and sorcery. So what was your thinking in picking a Warlord book? It's Warlord 33 in particular.
The reason behind this is that I just happened to remember that Travis Morgan, the Warlord, was an Air Force pilot. I believe he was a lieutenant colonel. And from the first issue, he was an SR-71 pilot. And he was flying a mission over Russia and got hit by a missile and tried to make it back to his base and crossed to the North Pole and followed the curvature of the Earth,
and
but
bam,
mistakenly,
Taurus.
Yeah, he found a tunnel that actually it is still watching the horizon. You know, he followed the curvature of the Earth down this tunnel into this magical realm inside of the Earth that that we call Savage Land, or I mean Scar Taurus. It's completely different from Savage Land.
this guy is not Kazar. Well,
that's
maybe
true.
A little, but
an argument could be made.
Now, of course, not only was Travis Morgan an Air Force vet, his creator, Mike Grell, served in the Air Force as well. So that's probably why he decided to make his hero an Air Force man as well.
We had a conversation the other day, and I, about the reasons for getting into and out of comic books throughout the years.
Yep.
And myself, I got into it when I was probably about 12, 13 years old, maybe a little bit younger. And then I got out of it when I was about 17, solely for the reason that they upped the cover price. When I started collecting, it was 65 cents. They upped the cover price to $1.25. And I said, no more.
This is why I love you, buddy, because you got to draw a line somewhere. Exactly. Yeah.
That's why I love the quarter bid. But I did get back into it later on, and I got some of the more expensive books I was able to get discounted. And one of those was The Longbow Hunters. I got back into Green Arrow. He was a character that I always found very interesting. And actually going back and reading the early stuff, I realized just what a ripoff of Batman he was. But Mike Grell.
What, the Arrowmobile and the Arrow Cave?
Yes, all that stuff. But later on, Mike Grell took him over and took him in a completely different direction. Yes. And that was where I picked up Green Arrow, and I really got interested. And so then I go back and I see an issue of Warlord, and I'm like, what is Green Arrow doing wearing a loincloth?
and how did his blonde hair turn white?
There are strong similarities. I remember there was an issue, and it might have been during the Invasion crossover, where they met each other and made jokes about it. So I don't know if you remember the exact issue that I'm thinking of.
Yes, I do remember that.
Or at least one of your listeners can research and pull that out. But I wouldn't mind seeing that again.
And of course, you shave off the facial hair, and you have another Mike Grell creation, John Sable Freelance. Pretty much the same face on all of those gentlemen.
Yeah. Now, I will say, I really do appreciate the artwork in these books. We haven't really talked about the content of this book. It's what every 12, 13-year-old boy wants to see. You know, you got your, it's basically Flash Gordon, right? So you got a guy, he's a little more technologically advanced. He's got some modern savvy. He meets these more primitive people. He goes in, beautiful woman, actually several beautiful women in this particular issue. There's Shakira, and who can do a cat, or perhaps is she a cat that can turn into a woman? I don't know. Maybe they'll never tell us. But either way, when she's human, she runs around in a little furry bikini, and what 13-year-old boy doesn't want to see that?
They get kidnapped by a band of winged hawkmen. No, they carry off Shakira. Early on in the issue, Morgan does point out that the Air Force never mentioned anything like that when they taught them about aerial dogfighting. So I like that. Then in a, I'm not going to lie, a strange plot twist, Travis is discovered by a group of dwarves of the Disney variety. I mean, I don't think there were seven, but if there had been seven dwarves, it would not have surprised me.
You know, I read it, and I really thought he had gone to Oz. You know,
exactly.
I expected the one to say, you're among the little people now.
He's a little shaken up by this. They help him recover with their pure White Lightning 200 proof, which one of them does point out, it does take a little getting used to.
200 proof, that's 100% alcohol.
Yes, it is, just in case anyone wants to do the math. But the good thing about pure alcohol is that it's highly flammable. And so our hero hatches a plan to rescue the cat lady, Lady Cat, from their stronghold at the top of a super high tree. And Travis rescues Shakira, tosses her in the water, and any listeners who have owned cats, they know that look, that sulking, disappointed look of disapproval that she gives him at the end.
Yep.
A pretty fun one-off story. Good choice.
Yeah, you nailed that one. The only thing I was gonna comment on the artwork, which I find visually stunning. I mean, it's
oh,
not
yes, definitely
Frank Frazetta, but you know, for this book at this time for 40 cents cover price. Mm-hmm. Oh heck yeah! I mean, this is quality stuff. You know, they pay a lot of attention to the detail work, and the thing that I like about this is you start seeing some similar features from other books. You know, they talk about the Hawkmen. But if you look at them, they're actually wearing the same straps that Hawkman wears,
mm-hmm,
even
right.
though they're completely unrelated, mm-hmm, except in appearance. And Morgan's helmet actually looks very much like Hawkman's helmet once they start developing. He's got the big feathers on the sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm led to believe that those are actual feathers, not the metal that Hawkman has.
I think that's right.
Yeah, it was a great book. I am a big fan of the sword and sorcery genre, and this for me is a really good blend of sword and sorcery mixed with modern technology. And even though they didn't go into it in this particular book, I really, you know, I just get a little chuckle every time he goes back to his downed SR-71 and grabs another magazine of bullets for his gun. Which, speaking of that,
never
on
ending,
the cover,
never-ending supply.
Okay, so in the very first issue, which was first issue special number 8,
yes,
if you got that, it says that he had 12 bullets. Okay, when he crashed. Now, over the course of this series, and there was 130 issues, he definitely had more than 12 bullets for sure. But getting back to
you
this
think?
Issue, on the cover, it's got him with his gun, and that thing, it's like a cannon. He's pointing it, you know, not directly at the, you know, the reader, but, you know,
just
you know
screen,
it's
but
it's
the
in
perspective,
your general perspective.
The perspective on it is so great. It looks like it is coming right at you in 3D.
Absolutely. And you know how many times he pulls that thing in the actual issue? Zero.
Yeah, I don't remember
Zero.
Actually much. I remember, yeah.
He's being attacked by these Hawkmen. You know, he's got a sword in his hand, and they're taking his woman. You've got a gun. You're not going to use it?
He's got the alcohol. He's got a plan. He's got dwarf buddies. Come on. You don't need a gun when you've got dwarf buddies. Also, they had 18 pages to fill, and Terry, and your script would have been 2.5.
Did you want to ask me if I thought it was worth 25 cents?
What was it worth? Oh. Was it worth 25 cents?
It absolutely was.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Good choice. Thanks for joining me. And Captain, thank you for your service.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Happy Veterans Day.
And that is going to wrap up this special Veterans Day episode of Relatively Geeky Presents. Let me take this chance to again thank my guests, Air Force Vets All. Jared Albrick can be found at Yard Sale Artist on Twitter, and hosts or guests on a number of podcasts at White Rocket Entertainment. He also appears as a regular on Pat Sampson's Long Box Crusade podcast. Scott Gardner is a co-founder of the Two True Freaks podcast network, and currently he appears as a regular on the Back to the Bins show on that network. If you're not familiar with Scott's work, I recommend his past shows Comics Monthly Monday, Tales of the Justice Society of America, and the Jonah Hex podcast Death and the Acrid Smell of Gunsmoke, all available at Two True Freaks. And by the time this episode posts, my buddy Terry will probably have moved from 2 miles away from my house to about 20 miles away. With twin babies on the way, he and his family needed a house with a little more space, but he's never more than a Skype call away. By the way, if you want to hear another take on Warlord number 33, the book I covered with Terry, it was covered by the most excellent Sutherlands on episode 14 of their terrific podcast, Warlord Worlds. So thanks again to all three of my guests for appearing on this episode. And of course, I thank them for their service. Now look, I respect the Air Force very much. But if I do this again in a year or two or three, I'd like to include folks from, you know, other branches of the military. If you or anyone you know served in uniform somewhere other than the Air Force, was a geek and a podcasty type of person, let me know. I'd like to have a bigger database, a bigger stable of potential guests for next time I do this. And anyone listening who served in the military, thank you for your service. Music in this episode was a couple of marches from John Philip Sousa as performed by the Gordon Highlanders. Thanks for listening, and a happy Veterans Day to all.